I think that at that time, none of us quite believed in the time machine. The fact is, a time traveler was one of those men who are too clever to be believed. You never felt that you saw all around him. You always suspected some subtle reverse, some ingenuity in ambush, behind his lucid frankness. Had Philby shown the model and explained the matter in the time traveler's words, we should have shown him far less skepticism, for we should have perceived his motives. A pork butcher could understand Philby. But the time traveler had more than a touch of whim about his elements, and we distrusted him. Things that would have made the frame of a less clever man seem tricks in his hands. It is a mistake to do things too easily. The serious people who took him seriously never felt quite of his deportment. They were somehow aware that trusting their reputations for judgment with him was like furnishing a nursery with eggshell china. So I don't think any of us said very much about time traveling in the interval between that Thursday and the next, though its odd potentialities ran, no doubt, most in our minds. It is plausibility, that is, its practical incredibleness, the curious possibilities of anachronism and of utter confusion it suggested. For my part, I was particularly preoccupied with the trick of the model. That I remember discussing with the medical man, whom I met on Friday at Linehan. He said that he had seen a similar thing at Tunbridge Inn, and laid considerable stress on blowing out of the candle, but how the trick was done he could not explain. The next Thursday, I went again to Richmond. I suppose it was one of the time traveler's most constant guests, and arriving late, found four or five men already assembled at his drawing room. The medical man was standing before the fire with a sheet of paper in one hand and his watch in the other. I looked round for the time traveler, and it's 7:30 now, said the medical man. I suppose we had better have dinner. Where's, said I, naming our host. You've just come. It's rather odd. He's been unavoidably detained. He asked me in this note to lead off with dinner at 7 if he's not back. Says he'll explain when he comes. It seems a pity to let the dinner spoil, said the editor of a well-known daily paper, and thereupon the doctor rang the bell. The psychologist was the only person beside the doctor and myself who had attended the previous dinner. The other men were Blank, the editor aforementioned, a certain journalist, and another quiet, shy man with a beard, whom I don't know. As for my observation went, never opened his mouth till all the evening. There was some speculation at the dinner table about the time traveler's absence, and I suggested time traveling in a half-jocular spirit. The editor wanted that explained to him. The psychologist volunteered a wooden account of the ingenious paradox and trick which he had witnessed the day before. He was in the midst of his exposition when the door from the corridor opened slowly and without noise. I was facing the door, and saw it first. Hello, I said. At last, the door opened wider, and the time traveler stood before us. I gave a cry of surprise. Good heavens, man, I said. What's the matter? Cried the medical man, who saw him next, and a whole tableful turned towards the door. He was in an amazing plight. His coat was dusty and dirty, smeared with green down to the sleeve. His hair disordered, seemed to me grayer, either with dust or dirt or because its color had actually faded. His face was ghastly pale. His shin had a brown cut on it, about half healed. His expression was haggard and drawn, as if by intense suffering. For a moment he hesitated in the doorway, as if he had been dazzled by the light, then came into the room. He walked with just as a limp as I had seen him in foot store tramps. We stared at him, expecting him to speak. He said not a word, but came painfully to the table and made a motion toward the wine. The editor filled a glass of champagne and pushed it towards him. He drained it, and it seemed to do him good, for he looked around the table, and the ghost of his smile flickered across his face. "What on earth have you been up to, man?" said the doctor. The triumpeter did not seem to hear. "Do not let me disturb you," he said with a certain faltering articulation. "I'm all right." He stopped, held out his glass for more, and took off a drop. "That's good," he said. His eyes grew brighter, and a faint color came to his cheeks. His glance flickered above our faces with certain dull approval, and went on round the warm, comfortable room. There he spoke again, still as if feeling his way or among words. "I am going to wash and dress, then I shall come down and explain things. Take some of that mutton. I'm starving for a bit of meat." He looked across at the editor, who was a rare visitor, and hoped he was all right. The editor began a question. "Tell you presently," said the time traveler. "I'm plenty. Be all right in a minute." He put down his glass and walked down toward the staircase door again. Again I remarked his lameness and soft padding sound of his footfall, and standing up in my place, I saw his feet as he went out. He had nothing on them but a pair of tattered, blood-stained socks, and then the door closed upon him. I had half a mind to follow, but still remembered how he detested any fuss about himself. For a minute, perhaps, my mind was wool-gathering. Then remarkable behavior of any eminent scientist, I heard the editor say, thinking half as he walked in the headline, and this brought my attention back to my bright dinner table. "What's the game?" said the journalist. "Has he been doing the amateur catcher? I don't follow." I met the eyes of the psychologist and read my own interpretation in his face. I thought of the time traveler limping painfully upstairs. I didn't think anyone else noticed his lameness. The first to recover completely from his surprise was the medical man, who rang the bell. The time traveler hated to have his servants wait at dinner for a hot plate. At that, the editor turned to his knife and fork with a grunt. The silent man followed suit. The dinner was resumed. Conversation was exclamatory for a little while, with gasps of wonderment. Then the editor got fervent in his curiosity. "Does our friend eke out a modest living with a crossing? Or has his Nebuchadnezzar phases?" he inquired. "I felt assured in this business of the time machine," I said, and took up the psychologist's account of our previous meeting. The new guests were frankly incredulous. The editor raised objections. What was this time travel? A man couldn't cover himself with dust by rolling in a paradox, could he? And then, as the idea came home to him, he resorted to caricature. "Haven't they any clothes brushes in the future?" The journalist, too, would not believe at any price. He joined the editor in the easy work of keeping ridicule on the whole thing. They are both the new kind of journalists, very joyous, irreverent young men. "Our special correspondent in the Day After Tomorrow reports," the journalist was saying, or rather shouting, when the time traveler came back. He was dressed in ordinary evening clothes. Nothing save this haggard look remained of a change that had startled me. "I say," said the editor hilariously, "these chaps here say you've been traveling in the middle of next week. Tell us about the Little Rosebery, will you? What will you take for the lot?" The time traveler came to the place reserved for him without a word. He smiled quietly in his old way. "Where's my mutton?" he said. "What a treat it is to stick a fork in meat again." "Story," cried the editor. "Story be damned," said the time traveler. "I want something to eat. I won't say a word until I get some peptone in my arteries. Thanks, and the salt." "One word," said I. "Have you been time traveling?" "Yes," said the time traveler, with his mouth full, nodding his head. "I'd give a shilling a line for a verbatim note," said the editor. The time traveler pushed his glass towards the silent man and rang it with his fingernail, at which the silent man, who had been staring at his face, stared convulsively and poured him wine. The rest of the dinner was uncomfortable. For my part, sudden questions kept rising to my lips. I dare say it was the same with the others. The journalist tried to relieve the tension by telling anecdotes of Hedy Potter. The time traveler devoted his attention to his dinner and displayed the appetite of a tramp. The medical man smoked a cigarette and watched the time travel through his eyelashes. The silent man seemed even more clumsy than usual and drank champagne with regularity and determination of sheer nervousness. At last, the time traveler pushed his plate away and looked towards us. I suppose I must apologize, he said. I was simply starving. I've had a most amazing time. He reached out of his hand for a cigar and cut the end. But come into the smoking room. It's too long a story to tell over greasy plates. And, ringing the bell in passing, he led the way into the adjoining room. You have told Blank and Dash and Choose about the machine, he said to me, leaning back into his easy chair, naming the three new guests. But there's a mere paradox, said the editor. I can't argue tonight. I don't have mind telling the story, but I can't argue. I will, he said, went on, tell you the story of what happened to me, if you like, but you must refrain from interruptions. I want to tell it badly. Most of it will sound like lying, so be it. It is true, every word of it. All the same, I was in my laboratory at 4 o'clock, and since then, I've lived 8 days. Such days as no human being has ever lived before. I'm nearly worn out, but I shan't sleep till I've told this thing over to you. Then I should go to bed, but remember, no interruptions. Is that agreed? Agreed, said the editor, and the rest of us echoed, agreed. And with that, the time traveler began his story, as his story was set forth, and he sat back in his chair at first and spoke like a weary man. Afterwards, he got more animated, and his writing it down, I felt only too much keenness in the inadequacy of pen and ink, and above all, inadequacy to express it quality. You read, I suppose, attentively enough, but you can't see the speaker's white, sincere face in the bright circle of little lamp, nor hear the intonations of his voice. You cannot know his expressions, follow the turns of the story. Most of us hearers were in shadow, as the candles in the smoking room had not been lighted, and only the face of the journalist and the legs of the silent man from the knees downward were illuminated. At first we glanced now and again to each other. After a time we ceased to do that. We looked only at the time traveler's face.